Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film community where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. Today we are continuing Season 5, which is all about contemporary Asian filmmakers, and we are moving on to our second filmmaker in the season. So far, we have looked at two movies, Uncle Boon-mi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, and Cemetery of Splendor, both from Thai director Apichatpong Wirasathakul, and today we are moving on to South Korea, to the filmmaker Bong Joon-ho. If that name sounds familiar, it's because he directed 2019's Parasite, which was all the rage last year, and rightfully so. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, and it won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It was kind of everywhere. And today, we're going to look at Bong Joon-ho, but we're going to go back a few years to 2006, looking at his film, The Host. The Host was extremely popular back in 2006, becoming the highest grossing South Korean film of all time at that time. It's since been surpassed, but it's a monster movie, but it's also so much more than that. It's very human, it's a family drama, it's funny, it's heart-wrenching, it's action-packed, it's satirical, it's political. It really does a lot, and it does it well. Before we dive into The Host, let's say hello again to our guest for Season 5, film fanatic and podcaster Omaya Jones. Omaya is going to tell us what he's been watching lately, but first, he wanted to follow up on something he said in one of the previous episodes about Apichatpong Wirasathakul. Omaya, hello. How's it going?
Good. I'm glad to be back. I wanted to say that when we recorded for Uncle Boon-mi, I was listening back to that, and I realized that I said that Apichatpong Wirasathakul is probably the most well-known Thai director. Mm. And I think I forgot about a film called Ong Bak. And I know when it came out in like 2003, it was big, at least on like my college campus, because mm-hmm. It's a martial arts film. And I just wanted to just give a shout out to that. Aside from that, what I've been watching lately is I saw a film. It came on PBS. It's a documentary, and it's called Advocate. And it's a documentary from last year directed by a directing team of Rachel Lee Jones and Felipe Belek. And it's about a Jewish lawyer who takes really hard cases. She defends mostly Palestinians who are caught up in the legal system. So, and we're talking about people who are arrested for what some people call terrorist attacks on Jewish or Israeli citizens. Mm-hmm. And it's a really tough film. She's an ideologue, I think, and that she's like an anti-Israeli occupation Jew.
Interesting.
Who's been doing this since like the 60s. And it's a really interesting look, you know, at an aspect of the legal system there that I was not familiar with previously.
Yeah. Wow. And you saw it on PBS, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came on PBS. Although I think the version they aired was probably edited by like 20 minutes for time.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious to see like what all was cut out.
Yeah, I wonder if it was one of those independent lens things they do. So I think if it was, that they'd have like a documentary series that usually they stream for a while too. So mm-hmm. I wonder if that is streaming. I'll have a look and see if I can link that in the show notes, because usually those are streaming for free.
Yeah. The series is called POV.
Oh, POV. Okay.
And I guess every other week they show a different documentary. This is the only one that I've watched so far, but I've got a few others recorded.
Yeah. I definitely have heard of POV. I'm not sure if those stream or not, but I'll find out. That sounds really interesting. And an interesting cultural niche that I am completely unaware of, which I think those are sometimes the best documentaries, is going into and just soaking in something completely new. That's cool. Well, the thing that I've been watching lately, I actually watched several things. So here we are in the middle of pandemic. And I told you about this, Omaya, but I have a couple of kids, and we're all home all the time. And, you know, that gets tiring to some in a lot of different ways. So my wife and I both individually had two nights away at just Airbnbs in the area. And she went and had like a nice retreat in the woods, and I went and watched a bunch of movies, which was great. I found an Airbnb with a nice big TV, and I watched several things. I watched 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I'd never seen before. It was my first time, and I obviously thought it was great. It's such a big deal in the kind of the scope of cinematic history. I watched Silence, which you loaned me, the Martin Scorsese film about the Jesuit missionaries, which was heavy, and I liked it. We haven't talked about that yet. It wasn't my favorite thing that I watched on my retreat. I also watched a movie called Babette's Feast, which I'll recommend. It's from 1987. That one was really good. My brother gave me the Criterion of that last year, and I had never watched it. But the thing that I watched that I loved the most was Alfonso Cuarón's movie from 2001 called Y Tu Mama También, which I had always wanted to see, and I'm a fan of him generally. I think last week I talked about Pan's Labyrinth, so I'm keeping my Spanish language connection going. But Y Tu Mama También is really interesting. It's a coming-of-age film, like a road movie. It's like a road trip between two young guys and a slightly older woman who's in maybe her 30s or something, and the two guys are like 18 or 19. And it's basically they're growing up, but it's also really political. It has this narration that's, it's not really narrating the story, it's just kind of telling side information, but kind of painting this bigger picture. And actually, I watched a lot of the Criterion special features, and Alfonso Cuarón talked about how that was directly from the French New Wave, like Godard's narration style. He kind of pulled that out and when he was writing this. Anyway, it's really, it actually shares a lot in common with Roma from a couple of years ago, that, you know, it's a kind of a love letter to Mexico and Mexico City, and it's just really vibrant and full of life, but it kind of, it's much more, lo-fi is not the right word, but compared to something like Roma, like I feel like Roma is really polished, and this was too, but it was kind of in a more realistic style. Emmanuel Lubezki was the director of photography on it. They've been friends a long time, apparently. I just recently learned. He also was director of photography or cinematographer on Gravity and on Tree of Life. We talked about him a little bit on the podcast when we talked about Tree of Life. So anyway, a lot to love about this movie. Have you ever seen it before, Amaya?
I have. It's been a while, and I remember enjoying it, but I guess I didn't realize. I think I read after the fact that it was, someone described it as a comedy.
Yeah.
and I think that like a lot of the humor escaped me the first time, so I've been interested to watch it again to see if I pick up on it more.
Yeah, I definitely thought it was funny. At the beginning, especially, the two leads are, they're at times insufferable because they're very immature, and that's kind of their journey of growth throughout the movie. But yeah, I really thought it was a good movie. Yeah.
I will say, of the other films that you listed, the one that stood out to me was Babette's Feast, because that was one that we screened.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I try to keep up, but I didn't know that.
I should send you my spreadsheet of all the stuff that we screened. Yeah. And it also includes the stuff that I would have tried to screen this year were it not for COVID.
Ah, yes.
I think it was a good list.
Yeah, I really liked Babette's Feast. We can talk about that too. I thought it was a cool, it's about this village in Denmark, and they have kind of a strict, stodgy sort of religious community there, to the point that even things like food, they think you shouldn't be too sensual about it, basically. Like anything beyond basic sustenance is a little too worldly, a little too sinful, maybe. And then this French housekeeper basically comes in and is a really good cook. And it's like it really drew a kind of a direct connection for me between kind of the spirituality of a food sometimes. Like you can have a spiritual experience with sensory experiences. And I think that, for me, that was the most interesting about it. But yeah, what do you think about Babette's Feast?
Oh, I love it. I just think it's delightful. Mm-hmm. We screened it initially when I started doing the Arkansas Times film series. We didn't do necessarily themed programming. But when, like a year or so in, I started trying to do things like line up films that I thought would be good for like holidays and stuff. And so we screened that in Thanksgiving, I think of 2018 or 2019, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think that one, it was actually sold out.
Wow.
You know, we didn't sell out a lot of shows, but that one sold out, and I was really happy about that. And we almost, you know, if it weren't for the fact that we were screening on physical media, we could have added a second screen to it. Mm-hmm. But especially, I love like sort of the muted palette, and the understated nature of the style of the film. And then it just seems like this wonderful story about sort of grace and appreciation, And I just love watching, especially just the end of the film when everybody, when they're actually enjoying the feast and they're trying to like repress their feelings about how they feel. But then it's just like inevitably throughout the evening, everything sort of comes out. And it's also just very romantic.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like that, the various suitors who turn up again and sort of recount, their history in the, in that village and the effect that it had on them. I don't know. I just loved everything about it from the first time I saw it.
Yeah. I think understated is a good word. Like even the set design of the small little village is really just simple, but kind of quaint in a way. And it's, it's really, it's a nice little world to get lost in. And, yeah, I think it does have a nice message too. Yeah, so it sounds like we both recommend Babette's Feast. Very high. I haven't watched any of the Criterion special features with that on yet, but I want to dig into those hopefully soon. But yeah, wow. We watched a lot of stuff this time.
One last thing about Babette's Feast. Yeah, I was just saying, so it's adapted from a novella by an author named, her pen name was Isaac Dixon, but her actual name was Karen Blixen, and Out of Africa was her autobiography.
Oh, so okay.
It's the same. Yeah.
So I did not know that. Wow. That's very interesting.
Isaac Dennison, not Dixon.
Wow. Well, watch Babette's Feast. According to what I'm looking at, it is streaming on Criterion Channel or on HBO Max. So there you go. You can watch that one. And I think Each Moment on BN is on Netflix, if I'm not mistaken. So there's that. All right. Without further ado, let's get into this week's film, which is Bong Joon-ho's The Host.
Mr. Kim.
Formaldehyde, dirty formaldehyde. Pour him into the sink.
All right, let's talk about The Host. So as we mentioned, this is Bong Joon-ho's film from 2006. And I guess let's just kind of set the stage of kind of what it's about. So it takes place in South Korea along the Han River. And it kind of opens with, it's a morgue, I guess, a mortuary. And there's an American doctor or scientist of some kind. And then a Korean man working there. And basically, the American orders him to pour a bunch of chemicals down the drain, formaldehyde down the drain. And the man says, well, this is going to go into the river. We can't do that. And, you know, it's kind of very foreboding. It feels kind of very sci-fi-ish in the first few moments. And then basically he does that. And there's this great slow pan over all the bottles of formaldehyde, that kind of revealing slowly just how much he's pouring out. And then it kind of has a couple little mini vignettes showing people seeing a fish that has too many legs or something, like a small fish. Then we meet our main characters, which is this family. It's basically a grandfather, three adult children, and then a grandchild. They have a small food, I guess a small like restaurant and a convenience store very close to the bank of the river, and like a small little trailer. They're serving some people, and basically the monster shows up. That's essentially how it starts. There's some people staring at something and they can't figure out what it is, and it's moving a little bit, and you look in the distance is this large thing hanging from a bridge. It swoops down and it turns out it's a giant mutant fish monster. The granddaughter is taken by this creature, and we'll talk more about the details of that scene in a minute, I think, because I want to discuss that. Then the story, for the most part, is them trying to retrieve the daughter from the monster who's taken her to his lair, essentially. And so that's kind of the basic setup. We are going to have like a spoiler section of this at the end, because there's a lot that we're going to not spoil, because this is a movie that I think you should have fun with. Bong Joon-ho clearly wants his audience to have fun as they're watching his films. And so we're going to avoid spoiling anything for you. I think that's kind of the general setup. Is that, did I miss anything big as far as overarching plot there, Amaya?
No, I think you about covered it. You know, the only thing that I would know, and this isn't a plot, but just it's interesting to me that this movie was inspired by an actual event.
Yes,
maybe that's something that we'll get into.
Yeah, we can go there first if you want. It's very political in a lot of ways, I think. And so, yeah, let's talk about that background a little bit. So there was an actual, it's like a military contractor or something who was American in South Korea, who around this time, I think maybe a year or something before, there's a name for this event, but I can't remember what it is.
The McFarland incident.
Yes, the McFarland incident. I guess that's maybe the name of the American who ordered this to happen. Basically put a lot of toxic chemicals in that same river, the Han River. There was no sea monster, but it was not good for the environment. And there was a big scandal about it. And so I think Korean audiences watching this, like, of course that's going to be on their mind. That's been in the public consciousness. So I think that's a really interesting direct tie-in to, current events. And then the American connection continues throughout the movie. And so, I mean, as an American viewer, of course, I'm keying into that. So we have the American at the beginning who orders that to happen. And then the U.S. military is trying to solve the issue with the monster who's loose in the city. And they end up developing a controversial chemical substance, chemical warfare, essentially, called Agent Yellow, which is sort of a play on Agent Orange, I think. And there's protesting about that. And so it kind of feels real world in a lot of ways with those touches that you have, the political turmoil of it. And then I think we can talk a little more about the U.S. connection once we get to spoilers, because the Americans end up, this movie is not thrilled with America. I guess we could say that.
I wouldn't say it's critical. And I think like the relationship between South Korea and America is kind of complicated because, you know, we've been there, we've had a U.S. presence, military presence there for, 50 years or so. And one thing I would say is I think Bong Joon-ho will critique systems, but not necessarily people, right? Because in that first attack, one of the people that we see trying to do the most in terms of fighting off the monster or the creature is an American, right? And so, like, it's very much aimed at like systems and not individuals who are just parts of, cogs in the system, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a good point. Hey, let's talk about that opening scene because I think it sets the stage well. One thing that I noted was so often in monster movies, you have to wait forever to actually see the monster, like lay eyes on it. And you just kind of get little shadowy glimpses or something. I think about like Cloverfield or Jaws or some of those kind of popular zeitgeisty monster movies. But this one, within 10 minutes, we've seen the entire monster in broad daylight running around. We see what it's capable of, which is kind of an inversion. And I thought it was really, I thought that was really interesting. And then actually I watched an interview that Bong Joon-ho did at a film festival, which I can link in the show notes, found on YouTube. And he said he didn't think too much about genre conventions. Like he didn't consider too much what other sci-fi movies do, except for that exact thing. He hates it when you don't see the monster for a long time. And so he said, we're going to do it right at the beginning. I thought that was interesting. And I think it set up well the stakes because you understand how fierce this monster is, because sometimes in a monster movie, you're not sure of that, and that's part of the dread of it. But this is, here's a pretty terrible foe right away, and you kind of see what it's capable of. But yeah, what do you think about the monster and like the monster's design and all that?
Yeah, the monster was a big deal because not only do they show it all, but I think, in American films, we are used to big special effects, big budgets, and doing this sort of thing. And it was a big deal for a Korean film to be able to pull this off. And they used several different VFX studios. Some of them were located in Korea. Some of them included Weta. And I think there was maybe like an American studio that was also involved in creating the special effect of the monster. But you can also tell they put a lot of work into the design of the creature. So like they wanted it to be sort of realistic, but also to be able to do all of these different acrobatic maneuvers, which mm-hmm. is why it has these like long athletic arms and legs and things, and this prehensile tail. And then like the most interesting thing to me is like the mouth itself.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. it's like this really complex structure of all these folds and things.
Yeah. Kind of like a shark's mouth a little bit, where there's like layers and layers of things, but mm-hmm. more closer to something like the whatever the monster's called in Stranger Things that walks mm-hmm. around and has that mouth head thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently, I don't know how accurate to the final creature it was, but they built a prosthetic on set to have for like certain specific scenes where people are in the monster's mouth to have that. But yeah, I think like showing it from the start is like a brilliant way to do it. I don't know how you could film that scene any other way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a pretty big action kind of set piece right at the beginning of the movie. And so in that scene too, it's kind of a transition, I think, into one of my favorite things about Bong Joon-ho as a filmmaker. This is only my second thing to see from him, beyond Parasite, which we actually did an episode on back, I think episode 14 was Parasite. I can link to that as well. But, so I was trying to, you know, draw some connections there. And one of the things that I think he does so well is kind of the blending of emotional tones. Like he can get a lot of different emotional notes in one thing. So thinking about Parasite, if you've seen it, it's hilariously funny. It's really dark and dramatic at times. It's got some like scary moments. It's got, there's like a really effective family drama. And I think you could say the same thing about The Host. And most striking, I think, are the moments when it hits two emotional notes at once or back to back. And I think about in this movie, one of the, like right away in, at the beginning of this, when he loses his daughter in the crowd in that scene, that for me is one of the strongest moments here. And because, I mean, maybe it's like father fear that I have, but he has his daughter's hand and he's in a crowd and they get separated for just a second. And then he grabs her again and is running and realizes he has the wrong girl. It's a different young girl that he's got the hand of, and then panics and looks behind. And of course the monster is right upon her and takes her. And, yeah, really a harrowing moment where you go from this kind of heart pumping action to this like just heart in your shoes kind of dread that drops in. And it's really heartbreaking too, I think, because of Kong Ho Song, who is the lead here. His performance is fantastic. But yeah, that scene is, so that comes at the end of like a really long action scene. And then you see it dive into the water with her kind of clutched in its tail, which is this long kind of tentacle-esque tail. It's really a striking moment and opening to this movie, I think.
Yeah. And I think there's something about the way Bong Joon-ho shoots it and frames everything. So, I mean, maybe we can talk about sort of like how he, like his process some, mm-hmm. but like there's a real like Western influence. And I know like people like Tarantino have compared him to like Steven Spielberg, mm-hmm. And his films are, they're just shot in such a way that you like, he's just such a strong visual storyteller. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And like in that shot in particular, once he realizes that he has the wrong child, like I just noticed when I was watching it again, just the way the camera stays tight on the father's face, mm-hmm. as he sort of slowly realizes what's happening. He turns around and he's running backwards, but also is trying to stop his momentum. Mm. And it's just like, it's really affecting, because like you see that all of like this emotion in his face before you actually see what he's realizing, which is that he has the wrong child and that this monster is coming for his daughter.
Yeah.
Straight at him.
Yeah. Dang. I'm like reliving it as you describe it. That's such a good movie. I think, and so that's for me, like as far as among other monster movies, this one really nails the human drama of it with stuff like that. And there's some, several other moments like that I think about so one thing about Kong Ho Song's character, whose name I'm about to look up, is Gong Du. And he's, when we first meet him, he seems like he's just kind of a slacker, pretty aimless in life. But there's a great moment in the middle of the movie where his father, the grandfather, who's He Bong, I'm probably mispronouncing these Korean names, But he gives this big speech about why you should be kind to him as his siblings, because they're kind of mean to him. And, you know, he had a really rough childhood, and this really moving speech that, you know, again, in the middle of all this monster craziness, just really grounds this thing emotionally really, really well.
Yeah. And I think I don't know how much we're going to talk about right now, but every member of this family sort of has their issues. Mm-hmm. And with him, what I thought was really touching was that the first time we see him, you know, he's asleep. He does this thing where he kind of just goes to sleep randomly. And he can't help it.
And they're saying, how can you sleep at a time like this? Your daughter's missing. Like, yeah.
But then as soon as, like in the beginning of the film, as soon as he sees hears his daughter's voice, he wakes up, you know, it's like this moment where it's just like, he just realizes like, oh, there's a thing that I have to, you know, I have to be there when my daughter gets back from school. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in that scene, we also find out that his brother is an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Then we're introduced to the sister via TV, through her metal performance. And like what we just see is like the family is sort of broken. I don't know if that's the right word, but like they're just like, they all have their issues that they have to work through. And it's just structurally like every character like sort of gets an arc, you know, it's really like tight filmmaking.
It is. Yeah. It's a full two hours long. But it goes so quickly.
Well, no, I mean, it's everything's just structured so well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly when he started this, but I was reading an interview with an editor who worked on Parasite, and he talked about how, you know, he has the storyboards, which is normal for movies. People storyboard, especially in action movies like The Host, you would storyboard. But because he's so confident in the storytelling ability of the storyboards, he does not shoot master shots and does not shoot coverage. So like the idea
just shoots that. Wow.
Right. Like, so like the idea of what you're going to shoot is so specific and worked out through the act of creating the storyboards that you just kind of, you're locked into it, you know? And so I think he just has this really well developed visual sense of storytelling, that not a lot of action directors necessarily have.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so on the visual side of stuff, there's a couple of, really one kind of recurring image that I thought was really effective. And that's kind of like an image of like mist or fog. And you see it in a few different ways. Like the first thing I think that we see, is pretty striking. It's just kind of the camera pauses and the daughter actually, or the granddaughter, Hyun-seo, is looking at this beer can that has fallen in the grass and it's fizzing out, just like shooting out a little fountain of beer. And it's just kind of like an odd little moment. But then as you watch, there's multiple moments where we see that exact same thing again from a beer can, but we see mist coming out of there's like watery mist coming out of some turbines or something. And then that shot cuts directly to a truck that is got a ton of like noxious looking exhaust coming out. So it's just a kind of a recurring motif. And then at the very end, which this isn't really a spoiler to say, but there's the Agent Yellow, we do see like this really noxious looking kind of gaseous substance. So it's a really interesting kind of visual recurring motif. And that I think is just kind of, for me, that was reminding me about just the issue of pollution, which this whole thing is kind of symbolic of, you know, if pollution is harming people and embodied in this literal fish monster. But yeah, I thought that was a really effective kind of visual motif.
Yeah. But so going to the point, the thing about the pollution, though, what I thought was funny was just that, you know, the film opens up with them pouring the chemicals into the river, which leads to the creation of this monster. But when the people who are standing by the river see the creature hanging under the bridge and then it swims towards them, the first thing they do is they start throwing all of their food and stuff at it, trying to feed it.
Yeah, that's really funny. They're like, they're just throwing stuff at it. And then first thing it grabs is a beer can, I think. There's a kind of recurring beer can thing. And actually, the father gives his daughter one. And there's kind of a funny joke about that. But That's a good point. Something else that I think that's kind of reminded me of some stuff in Parasite is kind of the symbolic. So there's like all the satirical stuff going on, but then also just like symbols. With Parasite, there's that stone, you know, that represents fortune, and the son is really kind of obsessed with it. And it's a little bit ambiguous as to how exactly the meaning of that plays into the movie Parasite, but it's there the whole time. And it's kind of a visual thing that you kind of can grasp onto, like they're obsessed with trying to not be poor, right? But in this, there's, it's only lasts, I think, about half the movie, but there's this ramen cup that he's filled up with coins. And that's, again, that's, we just have met him at the beginning and realized, you know, he's seems like maybe a slacker at work and that kind of thing. But like you're saying, he really does care about his daughter, and he has this secret stash of coins, which, you know, just at surface level seems out of the realm of possibility of, I don't know, we don't expect him to be a good father, but then he just kind of surprises us that he really, really loves his daughter, and he's very attentive. And so then he has this ramen cup full of coins that comes up again and again in the movie. And it's almost like a physical representation of his love for his daughter. And at one point it gets taken away, and he has to use it, spend it on something. And it's really heartbreaking for him to lose that. But yeah, just that kind of latching onto physical items that mm-hmm. represent something bigger, I think is a really effective thing that I've seen now in two of Bong Joon-ho's films.
Yeah, you know, we kind of talked about this before, and we're going to talk about Snowpiercer more next time. And I was saying how, like, the first time I saw it, I didn't care for it, but I'm curious to watch it again, because the films of his that I've seen since then, I have really enjoyed because mm-hmm. of his skill. And so I'm wondering if there's something that I just missed the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've not seen Snowpiercer. I'm excited. It's an English language, pretty much all, right? The Snowpiercer is?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, an English language film from a Korean director for next time. Back on the kind of the mixing of emotions, I think probably the strongest moment of that in this was where I was like really moved emotionally, but then suddenly was like trying not to laugh. And I was like, should I feel bad for wanting to laugh at this? And that's when they're at the memorial. They're like grieving, right? And they're looking at her photo, and there's all these pictures of people that the monster has taken, which is so interesting. Like, you kind of realize what kind of movie this is going to be when we see the big monster scene that we've been talking about, and then you see this memorial, and it's like, of course that's what we would do. We'd put up a memorial, like, you know, if it was 9/11 or something. Mm-hmm. And they are looking at her photo, and they're crying and weeping, and it's like really emotional. And then they kind of fall down and are almost like wrestling and kind of writhing, and it's really funny. And I was like, oh my gosh, am I supposed to laugh at this? But it really felt funny. And then it kind of goes back to emotional again, kind of really quickly and deftly. And it just really was striking. And it also, like, I think if I had seen this before I saw Parasite, I would wonder, like, was that intentional? Was he like accidentally being funny there, and like, because he doesn't know what he's doing? But with Parasite, there's a very similar moment for me that I laughed. It's when someone is knocked down the stairs, I'll say, because the camera movement of it is like, so like, it's like the camera just glides over, and then you see this shocking push, and it's really funny, but then you're like, oh my gosh, like, she's probably really injured. So it was a really similar, just kind of like mixing that humor and that, mm-hmm. Kind of emotional gut punch at the same moment. Yeah. So I thought that was really well done.
Yeah. You know, I think shifting tones like that, I think is some people say it's difficult to do, but maybe the key is just to just do it, you know, and just kind of just do it and see what happens.
You know, and actually one thing, so an interviewer asked him about not exactly that, but just, you know, how did you get the balance right between humor and pathos and horror and all of that? And he said, actually in a couple different interviews, he has the same kind of answer. I guess he gets this question a lot. And he said, you know, it's not like I'm a bartender and I have to just get 10% of this and 20% of this just to get, you know, the exact right cocktail. I just write it that way. Basically, it sounds like he's just that good at writing, but that's not exactly the way he said it. But he just said, like, I just write it that way. And he said, that's kind of how humanity is. You know, you might go to a funeral, but there can be a funny joke there too. And just kind of like, that's the way humans work. And I thought that was a really interesting way to put that. There's another moment that kind of mixes, it's more of an action scene that just suddenly is funny, which I guess that's not as uncommon as the other, but when they're escaping from, so they're taken to a facility because basically we find out anyone who had contact with the monster is probably carrying a virus of some kind. And so they are all kind of quarantined in this area, and they have to escape because he gets a phone call from his daughter and finds out she's still alive. And the escape scene, when they actually it's also like a little mini heist caper, and they there's just a really funny moment. Like it's all kind of funny, but then when the police officer who's been so rude to them, he's like almost catches them, and he's just like hanging out of the van, and he just like very slowly pushes his face out of the window. It just really made me laugh. So yeah, just another kind of action comedy moment, I guess. That was really well done.
Right. And then I think like right after that is the scene where they're having to deal with the smugglers or like the underground or the people who sort of like help them
obtain
a vehicle and weapons. And mm-hmm. I just think he's a really skillful filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about it now, just realizing how funny actually the movie is, despite the fact that it's also at times very affecting and a bit of a tearjerker.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me. The extent to which this is kind of changing gears, but just the extent to which like growing up in a culture that's not exactly free, but like you're sort of, you live there. Like, so Korea has this long history of censorship in film. Mm-hmm. Bong Joon-ho grew up in that. And then it became sort of more liberal as he got older. And by the time he actually entered the film industry. And so I'm just thinking like that in contrast to the last director we talked about, who doesn't view himself as political at all. And I think that a lot of that is just like trying to avoid getting on the wrong side of the political system mm-hmm. in Thailand. But like Bong is just very free to like skewer the government, the police, the American military. And he feels like confident that he can do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there won't be any repercussions. And I think I just like the freedom, you know, that I sense from that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He seems to have fun with that too. Like, yeah, this movie's pretty unabashed in its criticism of U.S. government and handling of things there. And then I think like something like Parasite is pretty critical of like poverty gap and that kind of thing. And but at the same time, and yeah, so like it's doing all these different things that we've been talking about. It's funny, it's serious, it's thrilling. It's like he understands that he can do these serious things, like, you know, criticize government systems, but at the same time he understands the magic of the movie. It's like this should be a fun experience, and so that's not to take away from movies that are less quote unquote fun. I mean, looking at the last two movies you talked about, like Night and Day, as far as like the tone and mm-hmm. I mean, this is like a popcorn movie basically. It's like a blockbuster compared to the art films we've been watching from Thailand. But yeah, just there's a sense of fun that in this and in Parasite that I sense from him, and I appreciate that as a film viewer.
There was a tweet I remember reading, and it kind of like altered my perspective. It's just saying that like in Korea, Bong Joon-ho is a blockbuster filmmaker, right? And just like the idea that like, oh, you know, because here it's a foreign film.
Yeah.
I think if you like knowing that going in, it kind of colors your perspective. But if you just step back and think about it, it's like, you know, this is no different than like Jaws or Jurassic Park or whatever Spielberg monster movie I can think of. Mm-hmm. It operates on the same continuum.
I had some definite Jurassic Park feeling moments in this. So basically I can talk about it. There's like two little things within about 30 seconds that really reminded me of Jurassic Park. And that was, so the granddaughter, whose name is Hyun Seo, and, this little boy who, is also taken. Basically there's a lair where the monster is, he's taking people in his mouth and then barfing them out into this sewer area. Which is really gross, but if some of them he's grabbed with his tail instead, and that's how some of them have survived. But it's just these two kids there, but they're kind of figuring out a way if they can maybe escape, and then they hear the footsteps, and it was straight out of Jurassic Park with the T-Rex and the water cup and all of that, and you see the ripples, kind of famous moment, took me directly to that. And then shortly thereafter, they are kind of cowering in a smaller tunnel to escape from it. And it reminded me so much of the raptors in the kitchen scene at the end of Jurassic Park as well. So yeah, I think he must be cognizant of that. And he, in one of the interviews, he was talking about Spielberg quite a bit. So I think he must be a fan.
Yeah. Did you catch that? So at the first time we're introduced to Gangdu at the food stand and he's asleep. Mm-hmm. There's a little boy who is trying to steal.
Oh, is that the same kid?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
And his brother shows up and pulls him away. So we're introduced to all the principal characters with, like, in the first 15 minutes of the film.
Because we don't see them again until maybe halfway through or so. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about them because I think they're really interesting characters. So it's a big brother and a little boy. And they are homeless, we find out. And they are taking food from the food stand because they're kind of looting, I guess you might say. But it's really interesting. And I think there's some other tie-ins to Parasite here, looking at like poverty and kind of the way that it affects people. But they go in and they're taking food, and the son, or sorry, they're not the son, they're brothers. The kid, the younger brother, starts to take some money, and the older brother says, no, we're not taking their money. We're not thieves. And then he uses a Korean word. It was in the subtitles. It didn't translate. And that word, I'm going to find it here.
Ciori, C-O-R-I. Yeah, right. Yeah, I was looking that up because, like, the idea is that there's no direct translation, but I found a site that kind of translates it to stealing for fun. And the idea is that historically, I'm actually just reading this verbatim from the site, but historically, youngsters would steal fruits, vegetables, and crops to appease their hunger, considered tolerable action in the past, as long as their actions did not cause the farmer serious financial damage. Currently is regarded as a crime, but yeah, I guess so. It used to be common that, you know, if you're taking food to feed yourself because you're hungry and you need it, it used to be considered just kind of like okay.
Yeah,
I guess.
So the big brother talks about it after they leave. He says something about, you know what CRE means, and he calls it an old borrowing game. So it's sort of this idea that, you know, he doesn't think ill of the people he's taking from, but he needs it. It's kind of the vibe I got from it. I don't know. We're all in this together kind of a feeling, even though he's taking what he needs. But it really made me think about... So first of all, in one of the interviews I watched with Bong Joon-ho, he talked about kind of the power dynamics that play in the movie. And so we have the way he explained it, and I think this sums it up well, is essentially there's this family at the center of the story, and they're weak and they're poor and they need help from their government. And at every turn, their government is stopping them, is being an obstacle instead of helping them. And instead of that, we have the weak helping the weak, basically. So we have these two brothers who are experiencing homelessness, and you get a sense that they would have shared with them if they weren't there to take it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then Bong Joon-ho also made the point that once the two children are trapped, the older girl is taking care of the younger boy. And so it's like the weak are taking care of the weak. The people in power are ineffectual, basically, and ineffective. And, you know, kind of what I mentioned with Pan's Labyrinth last week when we talked about what we've been watching, just like the sense that certain filmmakers, like, and maybe it has something to do with like being marginalized at some time in your life, I don't know, but like seeing, just understanding power dynamics that way and seeing the kind of shared humanity that is not uncommon, and kind of putting the marginalized people at the center of the story and showing their goodness, I think. So I really like that. So then the Parasite connection for me, I think you have sort of the same thing, even though in Parasite, I think everyone's kind of at each other's throats at different moments. And this is going to be spoilers for Parasite, I guess. I'll kind of dance around it so I don't have to say it's a spoiler, but essentially you find out there's a person in Parasite who is trapped in a certain situation, if you know what I'm talking about, Amaya. Yes. And they have the opportunity to get out of that situation and they don't. And they I think it's sort of symbolic of poverty and cycles of poverty and how there's, I'm not an expert on like economics, so I'm going to talk about kind of the little pieces that I've heard, and don't quote me on anything here, but basically I think there's an attitude that, you know, if you give money to the poor, that'll fix it. But sometimes there's, you know, they also need empowerment, because this person who's trapped in Parasite, I think this is all he knows. And it's like the idea is that it's really difficult to break out of that cycle of poverty. And I think there's a really similar moment in The Host when the younger boy finds out that Hyunseo's family owns a convenience store and they have food all around them. And there's this great scene where he's saying, "Oh, do you have ramen?" She's like, "Of course we have ramen. Do you have this kind of snack and this kind of snack?" And it's like basically gas station snacks, but it's like the best thing he can imagine. And not knowing that he's actually been in their store, which is a kind of a beautiful little irony there that he's already taken food from them and they just didn't know it. But he has a line at the end where he just says like, that's the best feast he can imagine. And you just see how excited he is about it. And it's just like kind of a similar idea of like, this is like the highest he can imagine because that's his reality. And so just showing that kind of wealth gap, I guess, again, it just really kind of, I thought there was an interesting tie in there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a funny moment that I won't talk about because it's literally the very end of the film and it's very funny. I will say the character in Parasite, it is noted in that film that they're in debt. Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a connection here where once they escape from the hospital, going back to the scene where you see the father negotiating with these people who give them a vehicle and guns and he hands them a credit card. And I was listening to the commentary track on this with Bong Joon-ho and some film scholar. And they were talking about how essentially once he hands that credit card over to them, his fate is sealed, right? Because there's no way he's going to be able to pay that money. And I think there's this connection there. And I would like to read more about the industry of like loan shark type organizations in Korea that essentially prey off of people by getting them in the debt that they can never repay, you know? And I saw like a similar thing. There was a film, Burning, which I think is a Korean film also, where one of the drivers of that plot is characters and women in particular who, because of the society that they're in, are driven to accumulate large sums of debt that they can really never repay. And so there's like this culture of like bill collectors and people like trying to get you to repay this money.
Well, I've heard Burning is great. I've not seen that yet, but that's really interesting. Seems like just wealth disparity and poverty is something Bong Joon-ho is pretty interested in. So I'm curious to watch some of his other things. I wanted to tell you this only vaguely related, but like, you know, as always, it makes me want to watch everything else they've ever made. I was streaming this through a library thing, Hoopla, and I found out later that the issue was actually my internet was having an issue, but it was really... the video quality is really poor. So I think, you know what, I should just buy this maybe and see how much it is. So I looked on iTunes to buy a digital copy of it and it was $12. I was like, yeah, it's a little more than I wanted to spend, but maybe. But then I looked and they had a 3-pack of The Host and Mother and what's the one about the dog?
Something. Barking Dog Never Bites.
Correct. All three of those for $14.99. Like, that's a pretty good deal. I'm going to buy that. So I have those two. Wait,
that was on iTunes?
Yeah, on iTunes. A little Bong Joon-ho 3-pack. So, have at it. That's a good deal. So,
I don't want to sidetrack the conversation by talking about physical media. So,
okay. I know. I love physical media too, but, anyway,
I know for some people space is a consideration.
Yes.
Also digital can be cheaper. The only thing I would say is that when you buy something digital, you don't really own it.
That's true. Yes. Yeah, we could actually do a really interesting episode talking about that because I have a lot of conflicting feelings about it. But yes, I own them on digital. So there's that, quote unquote, own them, right? So hopefully I can get around to that before iTunes decides to take all my movies away. But yes, so I had a nice crisp copy from the iTunes store to watch of The Host. And there's a few special features to watch, I think, too, that I haven't gotten into yet. But all that to say, it's a good movie. So do we have anything else like not spoilery we want to talk about, or should we go ahead and get into spoilers?
I think we got to dive into the spoilers.
Okay. If you've not watched The Host, pause this episode, go watch it. You can get it on iTunes for $14.99 and a 3-pack. But it's actually streaming on Hoopla, which is like a library subscription you can get. And you can also get discs from the library, which is great. Anywho, let's talk about spoilers. So I think the big things I didn't want to spoil yet. One was the the death of the grandfather, which I don't really have much to say about that other than I thought it was another one of those moments where it's, you know, heart pounding action directly into like just tragedy. That's really emotionally well done when, and the circumstances of his death, you think he's going to make this final stand. Turns out that the lead character has miscounted the bullets and he thought he had one more bullet, right? Gangdu, and he realizes in that moment, and there's a great moment where he's just counting on his fingers and you're like, oh no. And then, yeah. But also I in a way saw it coming as well, just because he had had that big, the night before, that big speech about Gangdu, and it just seemed like he's not going to make it out of this. He's getting this big emotional moment. He's not going to last too much longer in this movie. And sure enough, that was the case. But it really, and it gets really violent. It's probably maybe the most violent moment because it's just really bloody. And otherwise we're just seeing kind of bodies taken up by this monster, but there's not a lot of gore to it. But I think that is one of the most visceral kind of moments. And then in the final scene, I think there's some kind of bloody deaths as well, but.
But I think like even the monster, when it kills him, doesn't even, you know, it's not like one of the people that he takes back to his lair. He kills him and he leaves the body there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As if the monster has some sort of like agency. It's like, this guy tried to hurt me and mm-hmm. this is what I'm going to do to you. It's spiteful or vengeful.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess like going back to the other thing about the debt, mm-hmm. and there's an element of this where once he hands them his credit card and he knows he's never going to be able to pay that back. Mm-hmm. You realize he's not going to get out of this.
Yeah. This is ruining his life. Yeah.
Yeah. But then it's incumbent upon for the rest of the family to come together once he's gone. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of this where it's almost like the Avengers, right? Where all of these different family members have these particular abilities and they just have to find a way to come together to use them.
We even have an archer in the bunch. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I mean, structurally, like the first time I watched that structure, I was like, this is like the Avengers. but better.
Yes,
which is not, I'm not trying to throw shade on the Avengers. Right, yeah. I'm just saying this is, it's a better film.
Yeah. Marvel is always my like go-to, like, yeah, we're not going to talk about popcorn movies, like Marvel stuff. We're going to talk about art house movies. But I love Marvel movies too. I really do. I enjoy them.
Yeah. I just, I love the fact that you have like these characters where there's there's the loser, deadbeat older brother, the alcoholic former student activist, currently loser younger brother, and then the sister who's a bronze medalist because she can't get out of her own head, right? And they all have to overcome the things that are holding them back to defeat the creature at the end of the film.
Yeah. And he sets that all up so beautifully. You get the whole show don't tell thing. He does that so well. And then it just all comes full circle, and it's really great. Yeah.
There are even details like the beer can, right?
Yeah.
So first, like, the beer is used as this bonding element because, you know, Gangdu gives his daughter a beer, even though she's, what, 12 or 13?
He says, oh, you're in middle school now. It's fine.
Yeah. And then he throws a beer in the river and the monster eats it. And then when she's in the monster's lair, the monster spits up all of the stuff. One of the things it spits up is this beer can. And then it's like, it reminds her of home, you know, it's like, it makes her feel nostalgic. So like, there are all these little just visual details that carry over. Those, like,
symbolic items, which is, I just don't feel like I see that very often in movies, but he does it really well.
Yeah. This is probably like the 15th time I've said it, but it's just, you know, visual storytelling is so skillful, you know?
Here's a great visual moment that, as a spoiler, so we can talk about it now, is also reminded me of some stuff in Parasite. Like that moment in Parasite, okay, we're going to spoil Parasite now too, when the maid gets kicked down the stairs and the camera pans over so like smoothly and it's just like gliding and the timing of it is just so perfect. There's a really similar moment here too when the younger brother goes to the phone company to track the phone call, and the guy's helping him, and then it follows him. He's like, oh, I got to go in the manager's office to get the password, and it follows him across this whole office, and it's just a shot that just glides along, and he kind of seems like, are we about to see something? And the way it kind of lingers, but then it just glides through the wall, and you see like, oh, there's a bunch of people in here about to ambush him, and the way it reveals that I thought was so well done, and just a nice surprise that like a gasp, but I think I was sitting here by myself just like, oh my gosh. But just nicely done.
And I love, there's this commentary because I get like the relationship is that they were probably activists together when they were students or something, right? And then this guy sort of, I guess, has moved away from that and has a real job with like real responsibilities. But was his name, Nam Il? Is the character's name?
That sounds right. Yeah.
Like he can't, you know, he just hasn't moved past his student activist days, which comes up in the climax of the film.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a sense of like, oh, this guy sold out. But then he also has this funny little joke. It's a joke, but it's also kind of poignant. Like, yeah, I make this much money, but, you know, I'm still in a huge amount of debt. Like, that's sort of the punchline is that he sold out, but he's still poor. So like, that's another sort of commentary on that debt culture maybe. But yeah.
And then that chase, like this. So not only is that real funny, but it's also funny when he gets out, because like he does something with like a, how does he escape?
So at one point he's surrounded and the guy says, you know, this guy, he's a fighter or something like that. Like, be careful chasing him. And he he jams something into a power outlet and it turns on the lights. And so he's able to escape and he's kind of on the outside of the building where they can see him, but they can't get to him. And then it's so funny because this guy's just double crossed him big time. And he runs past him and sees him escaping, and he just does this like power fist, like, you go, man, which I was such a funny little contradiction of like, yeah, I just screwed you over, but you're going to make it. You got this. Yeah, that's really great. Oh, yeah. And then there's a great shot too. So there's a little bit more of a chase in the streets, and he jumps over the side of a bridge into this grass, and there's like a really clearly delineated shadow line, you know, like where he's visible but he's injured and he can barely move, and he like rolls out of the way just in time. I thought that was a really great little tense moment as well.
And then like the last thing he does, because he is injured and he passes out, the last thing he does is he gets on his cell phone. It just made me think that cell phones come up a lot, you know, and a lot of times in movies now people try to shy away from cell phones, so you get a lot of period pieces or, you know, movies where they're out in the country and the phones don't work or something like that. But here, like, they really lean into the phone thing.
Yeah, that's really, I guess it's an interesting screenwriting challenge that, you know, if everyone just can text each other all the time, then information is just flowing. So yeah, it's another level of skill, I guess, to be able to manage that. Let's talk about the pandemic stuff in this, because it was very interesting to watch this in 2020, because basically it's presumed that the monster is carrying some sort of disease and that everyone who's been in contact with it is infected, especially our lead, because he had blood spray on his face from it, because he hit it with a sign, which is really heroic. So that's another moment that, by the way, that he seems like this slacker guy, but he really steps up in some moments there. But so then it cuts to, or later in the movie, everyone is wearing a mask, and it's like you can have this understanding that it's a nationwide thing. And we find out that the American military is doing all the research about this, and they're the ones telling everyone that they should wear this mask. And there's a line where one of them says something about he doesn't believe it's real. I think the younger brother, and the grandfather says, well, if the government tells us, we have to do it, you know. It's just so funny. It's so interesting. And then, of course, at the end of this, it turns out that the virus is not real. So it's sort of an inversion of the reality here in 2020. And then it's all a big misinformation thing. That's kind of the very final moments of the movie. You hear that. And Bong Joon-ho has been pretty clear in some interviews that that's directly paralleling the Iraq war. So again, being critical of the U.S. and the ways that the weapons of mass destruction, how, you know, that was supposedly the reason we were invading, and then it turned into a big misinformation thing, and that we're all laughing about, but oh wait, people are dying here, you know. So yes. A big problem and something to be angry about. And it's so interesting. This movie is so tied to its time period. Like, it feels like a post 9/11, you know, kind of thing. But still has just unusual resonance here in 2020 with the actual pandemic we have here. But
yeah. Oh, what did you think of the scene where the people are waiting like a bus stop, and they've all got their face mask on.
Yeah.
And then the one guy is coughing. Mm-hmm. He spits in the gutter. It's raining, so he spits in the gutter. And then this bus drives by and just splashes everybody.
Everyone freaks out. Like, it was so funny. Like, what a creative way to, like, spray a bunch of people. Yeah. Sputum. Yeah, so it was a really funny moment. Yeah, so many times in this, I found myself wishing, like, I wish we would take the pandemic this seriously. Yeah. Like people, and then the fact that it turns out to not be real. Of course, like, has no bearing really on 2020, but I was just thinking, like, people who don't believe in the pandemic right now should maybe not watch this. It's going to just fuel their non-belief. But I thought that was it's such an interesting parallel.
One of the most effective line readings in the whole movie is probably when they're getting ready to do surgery on Gongdu. Mm-hmm. And he recognizes, he picked up on some of the English that they were speaking. Mm-hmm. And he just says, "No virus."
Yeah.
Like he just recognizes mm-hmm. it. But then at that point, like, everything that he says after that just makes the situation worse. Yeah. Because everyone just kind of assumes that he's crazy.
Yeah, man. He's such an incredible actor. Like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So I'd only seen him in one other thing, and that's Parasite. Of course, this is 13 years different. And I think this is a bigger performance. Just in Parasite, he's does a lot that's really subtle. Mm-hmm. And in this, he's, yeah, like, screaming a lot, like that kind of thing. Like, there's one moment where, so it's like, you see the desperation of him as a father trying to save his daughter and coming out in big ways. And they just assume that it's some sort of madness caused by this virus. Like early on, and maybe he seems a little crazy in this moment, but I thought it was really effective too, where he is trying to demonstrate how his daughter could be alive. And he puts his cell phone in his mouth and, like, barfs it out into a bucket. It's like to show, like, the monster spit her out. Like, that's what happened. But it's really funny, but also, like, he sells it so hard that it's really affecting. But then later in the movie, when in that section where he finds out there's no virus, and it's just like everything he's doing, yeah, it's just he's acting that way, perhaps because of what his grandfather said or his father said about, you know, he, as a child, he didn't get enough protein or whatever. And like, that's part of his deficiencies in life. But it's like he's so desperate to try to escape this obviously terrible situation that is only being exacerbated by the powers that be, that they're just reading it as, oh, this must be part of the virus, and it must be in his brain. And so then they're like, oh, we're going to lobotomize him now. It's like everything he does is making it worse at the hands of the American military, who are just making everything terrible. And it's great when he escapes finally, and they're just literally grilling outside the door. And he's like, "You're just having a barbecue out here." It's really, because you're so mad at that moment alongside him. But yeah, anyway, it's a great, I thought that whole situation was really well written and well executed. So I guess let's talk about the final kind of fight mm-hmm. with the monster too. It's it actually has some parallels to Jaws a little bit, with, you know, in Jaws with the gas tank. Sorry, spoilers for Jaws. The gas tank being shot. It's sort of like a two-part killing there, where it ends up the homeless man, who is just kind of along for the ride, ends up dousing the monster with the gasoline, and then she sets it on fire with her arrow. It's a great final moment in that fight, kind of a satisfying ending to that. But that whole scene is really interesting because you see the political side of this story as the protesters are there and they have, you know, t-shirts that say free Gongdu Park, and it's like, oh, wow, this is like a societal thing, and the Agent Yellow is about to be released and it's supposed to be deadly, and it just kind of again brings in the real world stakes, and like that feels like a situation we've seen on the news a lot here lately, you know, with protesters and police lines and all that. And then the Agent Yellow doesn't work. Like, it seems to hurt it, but it just gets up and goes. So anyway, that whole situation, I thought it really nailed the ending of this, I think. And we can talk about the coda, kind of the very, very ending too. But what do you think about that final fight scene?
Well, once again, an allusion to the Avengers, they all have to work together to defeat the monster, you know? Mm-hmm. So like all of their various powers play some role in that final battle. And I just love like seeing the brother Nam-il with his Molotov cocktails. He was like, oh, that's what being a student activist was all about.
Yeah.
Like that's what he did. He made Molotov cocktails.
Yep. And I was certain he was going to hit him, but he throws so many, just barely misses.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Well, I guess it's hard. I don't know. Yeah, I've
never thrown one before. And then oh, it's the final one too. And it accidentally breaks right before he throws it. I'm like, oh no. A great little tense action moment.
Right. But that just gives Namju the opportunity to,
yep,
redeem herself from her bronze medal from the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful full circle for her.
Yeah, no, like that. I think it was really well choreographed too. You know, you see, like even so, the monster shows up this battle and it spits out both of the children. Mm-hmm. And I guess pretty quickly, Gongdu realizes that his daughter is, deceased. But then after they defeat the monster, he doesn't go back to her. He goes over to the little boy.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that they said in the commentary was is that perhaps, you know, like he's holding on to this boy because, you know, he realizes that this boy can tell him the story of how of his daughter, what she did in her last few days. And so there's this connection that he can get from this child.
Yeah.
And I thought that's really sweet.
Yeah, that's really cool. There's in one of the Q&As that I watched with Bong Joon-ho, he talked about, so they asked him about the decision to what was the daughter always going to die in the script? And he was like, yeah, that's part of the story. And like, I had to fight the financiers on that and all that to keep that in. But he said it was inspired by a movie he saw when he was in middle school, a Vietnam War movie with Gene Hackman. I can't remember the name of right now, but basically his son has been taken as a prisoner of war and he gets the team together to go save him. And he's been a prisoner of war for like 7 years. And the movie ends with spoiling this too. I've never seen and don't know the title. the movie ends with, they get there, find out he's been dead for 3 years, but, he has a best friend there who his son saved this guy's life. And Gene Hackman and this guy have a beautiful, tender, you know, crying together moment and hug. And Bong Joon-ho said that moved him so much that like, it's almost like a surrogate, like he understands, like there's a shared connection there, even though they've just met. And so it was almost the same situation where it's like his daughter saved this kid's life. And so he now kind of takes him on as a surrogate son. And so maybe that leads us into the coda, kind of the very ending of this also, not unlike Parasite, has just like a very, very ending moment. And then it's snowing as well, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's sort of the winter of the movie, like the end of the film or something. But we find out that Gongdu is now in charge of the food stand now that his father's dead, and that he is taking care of this little boy. And this little boy gets his dream of living among all this food. That was a beautiful way to wrap that all up. And great, great ending.
Yeah, I love the way that like the boy just pops up. Yeah, so the boy is sleeping, and then as soon as the food is ready, he's just right up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he's also very adamant that they turn off the TV because there's nothing good on anyway.
Yeah,
just as they're about to explain something about like the events that we just spent the past two hours with.
Yeah, really effective ending. I'm a big fan of this movie. I'm so glad I watched it, and I can recommend it just about anybody. It's maybe a little more violent than something like The Avengers. So if that puts you off, maybe not for you, but I thought it was great and pretty kind of universal appeal. I can see why this was such a huge hit in South Korea. And I think Quentin Tarantino said this is like one of his favorite movies the last 20 years or something. Like, so yeah, this has some crossover appeal. And I think any American audience would enjoy it.
I concur.
Watch The Host. It's great. There you go. I'm excited for next time. We're going to look at Snowpiercer, which I've never seen, but I love Tilda Swinton, who's in it, and I like Chris Evans as well. It's another Avengers connection with Chris Evans. But you can stream that, I believe, on Netflix. So that is easy to get to. So if you want to watch that in preparation for next time, I will be watching it for the first time. I'm excited. Any last thoughts there, Amaya?
I want to echo. So I was just kind of curious about what you said about Parasite. So I went back and I listened to that again because it's only like 25 minutes, your Parasite episode.
I could do another and one at this point. I have so many more thoughts having watched it a couple more times. Go on.
Well, what I thought was interesting is your guest at some point said the same thing that Bong Joon-ho ended up saying at the Oscar, or I don't know if it was the Oscars or a different awards acceptance speech, but basically saying that if you can get past like the one inch the wall of subtitles, then like it just opens up a whole other world of film to you.
Yes.
So I would just like tell people to seek out more subtitled movies, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Just
take the plunge.
And I feel like, you know, if you are listening to this, you probably understand that, but you know, spread the word to friends and family. Like, this is a movie that I think, like, I almost had a thought, like, maybe I could show this to my parents. Like, they don't watch a lot of subtitled movies, but they might like this. You know, it's one of those movies that you can share, I think. And this one, like, maybe something like Cemetery of Splendor is not going to be for everybody, but The Host, or anything it sounds like by Bong Joon-ho, just about, it's gonna resonate. And I think, or Ichimama Tambien or Pan's Labyrinth, you know, I think there's such a huge world out there that most American moviegoers don't give two thoughts about. So yes, watch movies in foreign languages. All right, for that we can wrap up the episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you want to support Art House Garage, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes. You can keep up with Art House Garage on social media at Arthouse Garage on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd. I've been doing a little bit more on the Instagram here lately, so check that out. You can also find video reviews on YouTube and reviews and event coverage on the blog at arthousegarage.com. We have an email newsletter, arthousegarage.com/subscribe, and that always has a couple of streaming recommendations that are not mentioned on the show at all, so some good stuff in there, as well as lately some good virtual events. There's I try to cover Arkansas events, but like, since there's a pandemic, there's a ton of virtual film festivals and stuff happening. So I'll try to highlight those. If you know of some, actually, too, email me, andrew@arthousegarage.com, and I can include as many of those as I can. I think that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.